Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back. This is the Masters of Modern podcast. I'm here, Alex Kessler, with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's going on, guys?
And today, joining us, Andrew Brown. Andrew Brown is a multiple top 16 GP and top 32 GP winner slash achiever.
Competitor.
How's it going?
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to the show. I'm really happy to be on it. What are we going to be talking about today?
We're going to be talking about the fact that Andrew is affectionately referred to by me as AB. His name is Andrew Brown. I like to call him AB. My name is Ben Bateman. Sometimes he'll call me BB. You guys are wondering what the vernacular means. That's exactly what it means.
Okay. That's good for people to know out there in the world. Today, we are talking about mulliganing and the art of mulliganing and or the faults that many people fall into when mulliganing. And then we're going to do a nice little deck tech on Scapeshift, which was a top two competitor this last weekend at GP Madrid. Mm. Speaking of GP Madrid, crazy. Everyone thought that Birthing Pod was a dead duck in the water as long as Tarmogoyf, and pretty much they ruined, or not ruined, they ruled the top eight of this last GP.
It's a very good deck. It's a very, very good deck.
Birthing Pod.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, definitely Pod really showed up this weekend. Like, I didn't expect Pod to do very well, and like it just won the tournament pretty much. The new innovation of Siege Rhino and extra Thrag Tusks
right.
just really took over the whole inbred metagame of we gotta beat Blue Red Delver and we gotta beat Jeskai Ascendancy.
Right. I mean, it was interesting. I'll eat my hat a little bit. Before this, I was like, Blue Red Delver, 20% better than every other deck in the format at a minimum. There's no way this is a problem. And then Siege Rhino is the card that comes out of the gates running and wins the whole thing.
Well, it's really difficult.
Or at least gets it.
I mean, it does make sense if you think about it. Like, everybody knows that Thrag Tusk is a good card, right? And obviously, in theory, if you're just casting a Siege Rhino is good. But if you can resolve a pod, which has always been why that deck is good, if you can resolve a pod, like, oftentimes decks have a really hard time dealing with what you can muster up. There's such a good chain you have. You know your deck so well.
Right.
But when you can Helix somebody, when that card comes into play, at a certain point, Delver doesn't have that many spells that are going to deal with a 4-5 very well, or like a recursive Thrag Tusk that's gaining you life. I mean, Lightning Bolt, like Bolt Snap Bolt's great and everything, but at a certain point you can't race them and like get in front of gigantic creatures that are gaining life well enough to compete. So it does make sense that a resolved pod is probably going to beat a Delver deck.
Yeah, you can definitely run hot where it's just you keep a hand with Pod, two lands, and a Dork, and then your opponent pretty much can't win the game. Like, in so many matchups, it's literally unbeatable. Like, just a turn two Pod, turn two Voice, turn two Kitchen Finks is very difficult for a lot of decks to beat.
Well, I remember, like, originally when Rug Delver was coming out, like, when this format was getting big, and Brad Nelson put this video online. This is, like, probably 2 or 3 years ago, and he was teching it for SCG, and he was just like, this is the best deck in the format. But then he's like, at the end of the video, he's like, but it's super, super bad on the draw. He's like, Serum Visions is so much worse than Ponder. This deck is terrible on the draw. And if you think about that matchup, so they have that hand you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You've got a Delver and a Spell Pierce. What are you going to do? You're going to play Delver, and you're screwed. You're not going to be able to stop Pod, and then you lose the game because you played Delver on the draw. Like, it's...
I think that's... I mean, there's a combination. I think one of the reasons that Rug did a little bit better is that you get a little bit better answers to Birthing Pod, just in general from playing green, than Blue-Red would classically have.
Right.
And then on top of that, decks right now aren't, like, most decks probably didn't come in being like, oh, I have to worry about how to handle a Tarmogoyf.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a new innovation. Like, if you remember a couple tournaments back, like in Richmond, there was a big influx of Tarmo Twin.
Right.
It was literally just Splinter Twin plus some fetch lands plus a Tarmogoyf, right?
Right.
I mean, it's a really good kind of, like, level 2 strategy where people on level 0 are playing this deck, people on level 1 are trying to beat the level 0 deck, while people on level 2 are just innovating and beating both of those decks.
Right. I mean, it's a classic joke that Tarmogoyf is the best blue creature ever printed, in the sense that, like, it's really, like, almost every single deck in the format of Modern at some point has had Tarmogoyf added to the list and done well at a GP.
Well, what was it we were talking about last week, right? How each color has that super, super good 2-drop, right?
Right.
So, Stoneforge has white and black, or white has Stoneforge and black is their Confidant. You were saying how you thought Pyro is the red.
Pyro is red, for sure.
And then Snapcaster's blue.
Right. Yeah. I was actually saying that Eidolon of Revel was the new red one. Being, like, rare was a requirement for that. But, yes, for sure, Pyromancer is, like, the closest thing. And if that isn't a requisition, that's, like, it.
And let's not forget Green has Scavenging Ooze.
Scavenging Ooze, right. Right, right. That's, I mean, that's, I guess.
And Tarmogoyf is all of the colors.
Yeah.
Like, Tarmogoyf's a gold card, right? Yeah. Hybrid.
Yeah, but it's funny, too, though, when you think about it, how, like, you know, each color in the color pie, like, each color sort of has its advantages. Like, those other cards all generate card advantage in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Tarmogoyf is just better than other creatures at 2 mana, so it doesn't need card advantage. It's just going to be, like, 4-5 or 5-6 for 2. So, like, it's worth 2 cards in that sense, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think it's, like, funny. It's, like, so indicative of green that that's what you're getting. You're just getting a beefier creature rather than
green's
an extra
just,
card.
This is it. This is what it does. It's bigger than everything
right,
else.
Right, exactly.
And will always be bigger than things because it scales up as the game goes on. While, like, all the other ones are like, I'm doing something tricky.
Yeah, I know. It's funny how that works. Anyway.
Green just likes to do what it does. Attack with 4/5s.
Yep.
So, that being said...
Let's get into mulliganing, the subject of tonight. For those of you who don't know, mulliganing is the act of when you first draw your 7-card hand, you are allowed to get rid of that hand if it's bad, terrible, or you just don't like it, and get one less card in a new hand. So if I have 7 cards, I ditch it for 6 cards, and then 5 cards, and 4 cards, and 3 cards, and you can go to 0 cards, which generally means you're not going to win.
The obvious, like, reasons you're going to mulligan are 0 or 7 lands, or, like, 6 lands or something. That's, like, kind of, if you on the most base level, like, if you have 0 or 1, or if you have 6 or 7 lands, that's probably going to be a mulligan. The question becomes, what are the smart moments to mulligan? And on top of that, format to format, how is it so different? You know what I mean? It's like deck to deck, format to format, it can be such a different conversation.
A lot of pros kind of talk about mulliganing as in it's one of the major 3 ways to become very good at Magic, where, you know, there is a certain barrier. Just like, you can play your deck generally correctly, but, like, deck choice is really important, sideboarding is really important, and mulliganing is really important. You can, before you start anything, the most major decision you make when you sit down to a match is what your mulligan plan is going to be.
Yeah, and I think depending on the format, you can mulligan a certain number of times. You know, I guess if you were playing in limited, going down past probably 5 is probably going to be a loss. If 5 is already pretty loose, if you get to 4, likely you're going to lose
the game.
You're
going to lose the game if you're on 4 in limited, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure people have won on 4 before.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, 4, limited especially is all about card parity. Like, your cards aren't going to be, especially once you start winning, aren't going to be that much better than your opponent's.
Sure.
So, you know, card advantage becomes so much more valuable, and making sure, and it depends on the format, but, like, making sure you have a lot of cards. But, like, the other side of that is, it depends on the format. There are formats like Zendikar where mulliganing down to 4 was not necessarily the worst decision because you're getting in there on the back of a Geopede, which is going to win the game for you all by itself.
So let's just do a quick examination, take a minute here. Where is the tipping point in each format where you think you've gone too far? Like, if on average Schmo deck in that format, let's start with Vintage, like, what, 3? Can you go down to 3 and still win a game in Vintage? Probably.
I mean, LSV had a story recently where he mulliganed to 3 and he won, where his hand was Lotus Land, Jace the Mind Sculptor.
Right, and that's totally that. That's right there. Card power is so off the charts that a mulligan to 3 is possible. But I think in Vintage, you can very comfortably go to 5 and even 4 sometimes and not be like, I'm just going to lose. Like, you can still recover.
Well, I mean, to be totally honest, I think it really depends on what strategies are the best.
Sure.
I think, you know, a conservative approach, which is, you know, mulliganing less often, you're going to do much better if you're playing, you know, ramp strategies or strategies that don't mulligan very well, where, like, every card matters, you need giant card parity. If you're going 1-for-1 with decks, so decks that don't really necessarily gain value but are just like lightning bolt, I land a threat and it kills you.
Right.
Those decks don't really want to mulligan because you don't draw cards, you just need to be able to handle what they're doing 1-for-1.
So then in Legacy, how far can you go?
You can go pretty deep because the cards that are best, I think, at mulliganing, the ones that can mulligan pretty heavily, are like combo decks, control decks that have really good draw card engines, tempo decks that, like, kind of can handle that situation, and those are rampant in Legacy. Legacy is made basically up of control, combo, and tempo. So I would say
in Legacy, then it feels like you can go down to 5 and still feel pretty confident.
If you're a combo deck, you can go down to 4 because you can just, I mean, like, it's a risk, but you can win off of 4. Like, there are
Painted Stone can just get you with 4 cards.
And if you're a control deck, you maybe want it like 5 as a minimum. And minimum is relative because, like, it's all situational. If you're down to 5, but your opponent's playing mono red, and you're playing a deck, and you have a hand that just can't beat mono red, you should mulligan. Like, your chances of winning are higher getting 4 cards than they are the guaranteed loss that you have in your hand.
So now in Modern, I feel like going to 5 is pretty bad. Like, I feel like 6, 5's possible. I think most of the power levels in Modern because it's a turn four format, I feel like you probably can't really go to five and feel very good about it, especially if you're on the play.
Yeah, and because Thoughtseize is a very relevant card in the format, mulliganing past six in Modern is kind of a death sentence most of the time. I mean, obviously we talked about the hand where it's like two lands, Hierarch Pod, right? You can easily win with that hand.
And then they just Thoughtseize you and you lose.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the crazy, I agree. So Thoughtseize being such a prominent card, such a powerful card in main decks and sideboards mm-hmm. can definitely house you. What about Standard?
Standard, I mean, with the Scrylands, because all the decks play a very high density of Scrylands, I think that mulliganing is a lot less relevant. Because you can keep a two-lander on the play, you can keep a two-lander on the draw, and you can kind of, like, stack your deck or, like...
Well, I mean, something to remember about Standard right now is, like, the major cards that are on the top of the format are, you know, stuff like Courser, where... you're going to gain so much advantage for A, you draw the lands from the top of your deck, so you're going to be going through your deck for the value you need, and B, with fetch lands, Courser acts kind of as a mini top, so you can literally choose what the top of your deck's going to be with much more efficiency.
Sure, but so that's this Standard. I was sort of more referring to like the average power level of us in the format.
I think it definitively matters. Like, okay. For instance, right now, mulliganing, you can go much deeper, but theoretically last year when it was all about control matchups that were like had okay card advantage engines, it was like Pack Rat needed, like, you were punished for mulliganing with a Pack Rat in your deck.
Right. And also, to be fair, Standard has Thoughtseize right now.
I mean, Standard does have Thoughtseize.
But it's less relevant because the strategy's just not as powerful, yeah?
Right, yeah.
The other side of that is, like, Thoughtseize, a thing that Thoughtseize does to a format is it kind of amalgamates the whole power level. There are not nearly as many decks that are like, I am hinging on this one card being good.
The strategies are less narrowly efficient than they would be.
So, like, Thoughtseize, what it does to a format actually probably makes it a little bit better to mulligan because your deck needs to be able to function mulliganing automatically. Like, your opponent's going to make your best card go away, so your deck should be able to function with one less card anyways.
Totally. So now for the final one, which is Limited, which I actually think, even though this is a Modern podcast, I think mulliganing in Limited is the most relevant. I feel like
definitely
it makes the biggest difference. And so now in Limited, that's, again, it is format dependent, but how deep can you comfortably go on the play in Limited before, like you said, the parity is you're so many shitty... So many poor commons in your deck that are just not good cards generally, that the density of those cards in your deck means you're going to draw mostly those cards. You won't be able to recover if you've gone past a certain point.
And I think this isn't... I mean, like, I think Limited leans the most to conservatism, where you want to mulligan the least in Limited.
Yes.
But I also think that it is format-dependent to extend as everything else, where what strategies are good, what are you trying to do? Like, this format... right now, Limited, you probably could survive a little bit better with a mulligan or two because there are so many like semi-slower deck. The power level is relatively even because of Morph, where so many of the creatures are just Grey Ogres for the first four turns, so you have a little bit more time to kind of find parity. Though on the other end, and the other side is like, you don't want to be in this format without playing three and five drops.
Right.
So if you don't have a three drop in your hand, you're probably not going to do as well as you would if you had mulliganed and tried to get somewhere.
Yeah. So, okay, let's ask this then. One of the like, entry point, you know, get good at Magic, become a pro type of things that people say to you is you probably don't mulligan enough, right? Like, it's a newer player, a more kitchen table player, doesn't understand the value of taking a mulligan. Like, they look at their seven, they have lands and spells, and they think, there's three lands here, there's four spells, I'm just going to roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
How important do you think it is to have a plan when you look at your hand? To have an idea of what you're... Yeah. It's
extra important.
Yeah, but what I mean is, like, let's say you look at that hand and it's four cards and you can cast out and you have the right colors, you have mana, you figure you'll draw those lands.
Well, you got to figure out what you're, like, what's your best path to victory? Like, what is my opponent going to do? What are they going to do that's going to stop me from winning? And how can I stop my opponent from winning? Like,
I mean, it is fully format dependent, so that's fair.
And, and even deck and matchup dependent. It's so specific, which is one of the reasons I think mulliganing is the most difficult part of Magic. Everything else you can, to a certain extent, ahead of time plan on. But like a mulligan, if I'm playing a deck, I need to know, how good is my hand? Did they mulligan? How good is their hand? Are they an aggro deck? Are they a tempo deck? How does my deck handle this? If I'm against aggro, a hand with all removal could do okay, but if I'm against control, this hand is terrible and you would never win a game.
Right. I think it's more polarizing in Modern and in Legacy, though. I think it's extremely difficult to look at your first seven and know that this hand could work against a large portion of the format, but if I'm playing against this certain deck, I'm just going to lose immediately. Like, if you look at a hand that has three spells, four lands, it's looking good, but I don't have a one drop, and you're playing against a pod deck that just has the hand of Hierarch into pod, then you're just going
to
lose.
You're going to be on the back foot the whole game and most likely not be able to catch up.
Sure, and that's easier to figure out when you're in game two.
So I think actually that's one of the reasons in Modern it's so important and so many of the decks are proactive. Mm-hmm. I think in Standard you can kind of be a little bit more of like a random amalgamation of what you're trying to do. But in Modern, like, you need to have a game plan A so that when you keep that opening hand, you're like, okay, well, if I'm Scape Shift, then I'm going to just try and get lands into play. Whatever my opponent's doing on game one especially, I'm just going to do my game plan. And I believe, and that's why I took this deck to the format, that this is going to beat most opponents because they are also going to do that thing, and my thing is slightly better than theirs.
Well, I think it's really funny, too, when you look at Modern. There are a lot of very powerful cards in Modern. So that classic hand of four spells, three lands, not necessarily what you want to do. You're going to have four good cards in your hand.
And there's less overall just catch-all answers. There's not like a Force of Will where, you know, in Legacy, if I keep a hand and I don't know what my opponent's playing, I can, as long as there's a Force of Will in there, I can know that, like, okay, if they're doing one of the 10 things that just auto-kills me if I don't, like, stop them,
right,
I can stop them because they have Force of Will. In Modern, that doesn't really exist. So being more proactive is why the format is so much more, like, semi-combo driven than normally, or it's a format that has Thoughtseize, which is probably the best, if not only, catch-all answer in the format.
Thoughtseize is kind of the catch-all answer. I mean, Bolt and Path are also really good.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of times, I play Blue-Eye-Red kind of control in Modern. So when I see my opponent play, like, Forest, Birds, like, there's, like, the semi-gambit game of, like, do I kill it and stop his pod? What if he plays a voice after this? So I think, like, all the catch-all answers in Modern, like, they're pretty efficient when it comes to, like, Thoughtseize, Lightning Bolt, Path to Exile.
Right, and that's why you also see most of the control decks are a combination of white, red, blue, and you use blue for card advantage, and or black-based decks, which are generally the mid-range Thoughtseize side deck. And on that point, I also wanted to say that Dig Through Time, I think, is a card that really helps this kind of do I mulligan or not conversation, because Dig Through Time lets you get to the more loose answers of things, the things that are like, oh, this is going to be slightly better against this and slightly worse against things, and that allows you to kind of mulligan a little bit more aggressively.
It's also, Thoughtseize is also a brewer's worst nightmare, because generally speaking, when you're like coming up with some sweet idea, and you're like, I use that word just for you, AB. When you're coming up with some sweet idea, and you're like, oh, this is such a cool card that's underutilized, you know, this is going to be so good, and then like, you get Thoughtseized, and your whole plan just goes in the trash can, which is why these
redundancy, you know, is so important.
Yeah, that's why Black Green X and Jund, like, those decks were so good for so long, because it's just a big pile of good cards that don't really care if you lose one of the best ones. You're going to draw something that generates incremental card advantage.
And the reason pros like to play that deck is because it's 50-50 against the metagame, essentially. And they can use their large amounts of practice time, their more inherent skill, they can just use that to their advantage. And instead of making it a 50-50 matchup, it's going to be 70-30 in their favor.
So give me an example for you, Andrew, of a hand, let's say in blue-white-red.
Okay.
A deck you play. What's a hand that's on the fence for you? Like, if you're let's say you're on the play, you're blind, you're game one, and you draw this hand. Like, and you look at it, what makes you think?
Well, if I don't have Bolt, Path, Mana Leak, or Remand, it's probably an auto-mull. Like, if your hand is like Snapcaster, Restoration Angel, Sphinx's Rev, four lands, like it's really hard to win with that hand because you don't have like the proper tools. Or if it's like Electrolyze, and just like if you don't have Remand, Bolt, Path, or Leak, it's probably audible.
You can't really interact with the early board in the way that you're going to need to get to that late game.
And that deck is all about getting to the late game, and not having a way to stop what they're doing early is going to overrun you very quickly, because as we mentioned earlier, the format is so much about just being aggressive and punching them in the face as soon as possible.
Okay, let's take that exact same hand, except that you're going to throw in a second Snapcaster Mage, and you're going to throw in a Path to Exile, and it's two lands.
Oof.
One of the issues with going at this kind of conversation is that the only way to really know for sure per matchup, per what you're doing, because like that hand, not great against most decks, but it's not the worst against something like
Black Green X.
Yeah, where like, you know, it would take 100 hands of knowing these 7 cards, like, because you could also draw 10 lands the next hand or draw 3 lands. So it's not the best way to kind of look at how to get better at mulliganing. The two things you really need to be looking at are, A, the deck I'm playing against, is this a hand that can beat them? Can I win with this hand?
But the point of this, I'm sort of trying to look at the basic concept of it. When it's game one, you don't know what you're up against, because that's so much of the time, like, the beginning Magic player, they're not even... When they're introduced to the concept of mulliganing more aggressively, they're not getting to a place where they're thinking about game two and the 6 cards they've brought in and they need to draw one of those cards yet. They're literally thinking about, oh, you're saying that I should, if this just has lands and spells and they're all good cards, I should throw this away?
I'm saying more, looking at card-specific answers is not the best way of going about it. What you really need to think is, like, as you said earlier, the problem is I don't have anything proactive for 4 turns. Mm-hmm. Like, Snapcaster Mage on turn 2 is not a card that would see play without the versatility of everything else, and you have nothing that offers that to you. Mm-hmm. So in that situation, especially in current blue-white-red decks, which aren't like the blue-white-red... the blue-white-red Geist Delver decks of the past, where then playing Snapcaster Mage on turn 2 was the correct answer, because the point is to get damage.
Sure.
But in that hand, you're not doing anything proactive.
Right.
The deck's not meant to be proactive. The deck is supposed to be reactive. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the rare ones in Modern. And so having that in a format where you need to be in somewhat answering what they're doing isn't going to be good. Yes, adding a path makes the deck a completely different conversation, because if they play a creature, you can stop what they're trying to do. And you have Snapcaster Mage to answer the second one on turn 3. And then you have Restoration Angel. And by that point, you hopefully drew a Bolt or something.
Sure.
So... looking at what you're doing in that perspective, card by card, it matters deck by deck, and it's better to kind of test your deck, figure out the best plan of action vaguely and the reasons for it, not necessarily card by card interactions.
See, but how many times do you get to the end of a PTQ, a tournament, something, and you've played all these matches, and you think back to your specific games and the ones that you did take that aggressive moment?
All the time.
Right, and when you get to that point, how many times do you think, I probably won that game because I mulliganed, or you think... oh, I should have mulliganed that hand. What was I thinking? And the thing is, because of the variance in Magic, obviously, getting, you know, mana hosed and flooded and all the variables that we can't, you know, plan for. You can try to play the percentages, but you really can't plan. How often do you feel like you did it correctly all day? I mean, how influenced by the results of those games should you feel, I guess, is the real point.
Right.
I would argue even pros at the highest levels, if they look back at their day, don't think they mulliganed perfectly every time.
Right.
But that's the problem with mulliganing, is like the odds of knowing what you should have done are impossible. That's why no pros agree on the exact strategy you should go about this.
Because you're just playing the numbers.
Well, it's not even just playing the numbers. It's that like it's objective and there's no way to really know what could have happened.
Sure.
Like I mulliganed that hand and I went down the 5 and that hand was terrible. Well, there's no way that the odds are that I would have known that that was a possibility. So the correct choice was still mulliganing. And beating yourself up for decisions like that, it's better to have made the correct decision and still done badly than to make a bad decision because you don't want the correct decision to end up badly the 50% of the time it happens. You know, something that I always kind of consider, and it makes it easier to mulligan, because I think a lot of the problem that new players or generally early game players like have with making mulligan decisions is like it's so ingrained that card advantage is king. And, like, that's the first lesson you get taught when you start playing Magic.
Yeah.
That going down one card is so scary and they don't want to do it because it could be worse. And everyone's also been bitten by, like, mulling to 6. Or, like, you know, no lands in my 7 hand, mulling. No lands in my 6 card hand, mulling again. No cards in my 5 card hand. It just, like, feels so bad. It makes you afraid of going down to 6 and 5. But, like, I honestly, when I'm playing, I assume that I'm going to mulligan to 6 before I draw my 7 card hand. And if I get an extra card in my 7 card hand, awesome.
Yeah, that's
hand is, like... way, like, now I'm way above what I expected to be, and then going down to 6 is just where I'm expecting to get to, and then once I'm there, that's when I'm really start thinking about, like, can this beat my opponent, or do I really need to go down to 5?
I once heard a theory that if you look at a questionable 7 in any format, I mean, it will exclude the older ones that are, like, so high power.
I've heard of this.
But if you, Modern and above, that you basically just, the highest converted mana cost, you just put it face down, and you look at that 6, and you just go, would I keep this? You know what I mean? If this was the 6 I drew. And I think that can be kind of interesting because it's like you do have those hands sometimes where it's like 3 lands and 4 cards and one of them costs 3 and 3 of them cost 4. And they're all really good and they're all like just what you want to be drawing. But you know that like you're not going to be able to execute your game plan unless you happen to draw probably a 1 or 2 drop in the first 3 turns.
Mm-hmm.
You might get blown out. even like if it's exactly the cards you want to be drawing. You know?
It's actually interesting. There is actually a full-on, like, very easy to kind of grok math problem that you can do to figure out what are the odds of succeeding. Mm. And
is this the Chapin?
Yeah, this is the one that is in Patrick Chapin's book. And he was kind of the first person to ever publicly post it. But before that, it was kind of like around all of the pro circle. But basically what it comes down to is you take 100% and you subtract it by the total number of cards remaining in your library that you do not want to draw.
Sure.
Divided by how many cards are left in your library, and then square that by the number of draw steps you have until you need to draw your out.
So for those of us that have no idea what you just said,
i.e. AB
is just totally confusing me. No, give an example, because I'm sure people don't want to like write that down and just do the...
So if you... So basically the idea is like, say you draw a two-land hand,
okay,
and you have, you know, I need a third land by my turn three or else I'm going to lose.
Sure.
So there's you, if you take this math problem and kind of plug it in, and we'll post this on the list below on rocketjump.com. On rocketjump.com.
Let's say you're playing 24 lands. So, and
yeah, we'll just on say average, for the 24 record, lands.
It's a monocolor deck. So just for the sake of simplicity, 22 lands are left.
Right. So you need one of the 22 lands left in your 53-card deck. You subtract 22 from 53. You don't want any of those cards. You don't want 31 of the cards in your deck.
Yep.
So you divide 31 by 53.
Okay.
A lot of math.
Sure.
And then you need that by turn three, so you square that by three. Or you cube it.
Okay.
That gets you around a 80% chance of drawing a land by turn three.
Sure.
So that means this hand is probably keepable. You have an 80% chance of getting there. And yes, sometimes you won't. But like that's if that is a percentage that you're comfortable with, which I think above 70% should be a percentage you're comfortable with.
Above 55%.
Right.
And I'll snap it off.
So, okay. I'd like to bring something up real quick. So, Andrew, you play over at Heidi Ho Comics in Santa Monica.
Yes.
That's how we know each other. And and I know that store and the group of players around that store has really improved a lot in the last year or two. Like a lot more high finishes and higher places and everything. And there was a friend of yours I know you mentioned who had shown up and really started kind of showing you guys a little bit about his method of mulliganing that taught you something. And I wanted you to share that story because I thought it was helpful to hear.
Yeah, like you kind of get better in plateaus with Magic sometimes. Like, you'll gain a lot of knowledge just from one thing. And when my buddy Adam came in, Adam Mancuso, he's, like, 2-time GP Top 8. He's played on the Pro Tour 3 times. He's an absolute monster, right?
Right.
Like, every time I watch him, I feel like I learned something new. But he was telling me, like, I was mulliganing way too much in Limited. Because, I mean, all we'd usually play together is Limited, and he would tell me that I was mulliganing too much. And, I mean, after I took that kind of advice, and this was right before I went to Oakland, where I got a top 16, he told me, don't mulligan so much, right? And I'm like, okay, I guess. So, I mean, in day two, I just started to not mulligan my two-lander.
You just rolled it.
I just kind of rolled with it, because he told me, like, it's better for you to run hot in Limited than to go to 6.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, it's the card. It's pairing the card disadvantage theory we were just talking about.
Well, and Limited is so much more about one-for-one matching your opponent.
Yeah.
So in that format especially, like, not mulliganing makes a lot of sense because, you know, you're trying to play a creature that's bigger than their creature or remove their creature one-for-one. You're not going to have many card draw engines, especially because in Limited, normally card draw engines are not good.
Mm-hmm. And you traditionally would mulligan more before because you just sort of, you'd get scared about the idea of your plan not being executed. Not hitting that land, not things not running the way you'd want.
Just like after seeing such a large sample size, I probably played about like 20 matches of Magic against Adam. Like, and he would rarely mulligan. I'd say he'd mulligan like twice out of like those 20 games, right?
Right.
And after seeing his results and just like seeing how it's succeeded for him and how it's succeeded for me, like, it's really been ingrained in my mind to mulligan a lot less in Limited. I mean, you can even see him in action. Like, he... In top 4 of Philadelphia, it's on camera, it's probably on YouTube somewhere, he keeps, like, the loosest hand. It's, like, 5 lands, a 2-drop, and a 5-drop in, like, Journey, full block Journey, right?
Sure.
And he's on the play, and his deck's really good, and he just draws land, and he loses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I talked to him about that, he's like, I know that happened, but I feel like my chances were better that if I draw another creature, I'm going to win the game rather than go into six.
Right, and that's something I wanted to bring up, is that I think so much more often than they should, people use past experiences of, like, bad beats to, like, explain their mulliganing decisions.
Anecdotal evidence is the worst.
It's terrible. Like, the fact that, like, even if you play in multiple GPs, at most you're going to play, what, 100 matches a year at GPs, and then that's, like, a crazy amount, and that's not a good statistical, like... pool that you should not be basing your information on. That, like, there are good ways of mulliganing, there are good paths to doing this, and following those rules, even if it loses you games sometimes, is statistically going to help you in the long run.
So here's an interesting point to bring up, and this I think relates to one half of it, the mulligan too much. The player that feels like they're starting to get better in any format, we'll say modern or limited, and basically the idea is they play too conservatively overall. They're afraid of their spell getting countered. They're afraid of going for it because they're going to get two for one. They're afraid of keeping the loose seven with two lands and five cards. How much more do you think you win by being aggressive as a Magic player, just in general? Just saying going for it, not being so concerned, not constantly thinking about what could they have.
I think you will win more if you're able to analyze the format you're playing and the deck you're playing with. And realize, is this a deck that is better if I'm a conservative mulliganer, or is this a deck that's better if I'm a liberal mulliganer? Do I mulligan a lot with this deck, and I can, like, can this deck and the opponents I'm playing, can the opponents playing punish me for mulliganing too much, and can my deck survive itself for mulliganing too much? And if it's not true, if my deck is like Valkyr, where I need every land I possibly can play because I need as many lands as possible to get in the play, then no, you should not mulligan as much. If your deck is like Jund, where if you get a Thoughtseize and a Bob and a couple lands and you're four, you're good to go, and you're probably going to win.
I guess what I mean, though, is on the subject of mulliganing, I think one that mulligans too much is often indicative of your style of play, that you're overly concerned with trying to be in control of your strategy in the game more than you should in a game that really does rely, in a lot of ways, on variance. You have to be comfortable with the variance to play
Magic. Right.
How aggressive can you be?
Right, that's to bring up the Adam point again. Like, he was in the same vein of him telling me not to mulligan as much. He also told me, make them have it. Like, let's say you're afraid of, like, a Thoughtseize, right?
Sure.
Just think of the odds that a Thoughtseize is in their opening seven.
Sure.
It's, like, it takes a lot. There's a lot of factors that go into it. Okay, my hand loses the Thoughtseize, and they have to have Thoughtseize. Like, that's multiple levels of, like, bad scenarios.
Sure.
So the scenario of make them have it is often really good because, I mean, sure, they can have it that 1 out of 10 times, but the 9 out of 10 times, they're not going to have it, and you can go ahead with your not as efficient hand, I guess.
Actually, something I wanted to bring up with Adam and you and the conservative versus liberal play style is that, like, there are many pros out there that if you statistically look, you can, almost every single one of them leans a specific way.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, Paulo Vita de Rosa, butchered the name, is, like, the highest percentage of mulligans. He'll, like, mulligan most hands if there's any problem with them. And there's a few other places that, like, players that are just, like, exactly the same way, where you can tell exactly what they're going to do.
Right.
And part of that is, you know, players play with specific styles. There are players that play control in every format, no matter what, and they do well the years that control is good, and they do bad the years that control is terrible.
Hello.
And, you know, depending on your play style, I think that really lends itself to how much you should mulligan or not.
That's
but something
totally fair,
that new players do need to learn, and I think a fear point for them is mulliganing at all.
Right.
I think they think, I got this hand, and it doesn't break one of, like, the cardinal rules of, there is only one land or no lands in this hand, I have to mull it. That's, like, the rule, but if it doesn't break that, they'll keep it no matter what. And a habit players should get into is looking at their hand, thinking, actually, about their mulligan decision, and thinking about, what am I going to do? What am I trying to draw? What is my opponent trying to draw? What is my opponent going to do? And if my opponent is not going to have a bad hand, and is going to do exactly what it's trying to do and the way his deck is built, can I beat it? And if the answer is no, then you should ship your hand.
Well, of course. And that's the whole thing, right? Is, like, if you do look at your opening hand and you do say that if they have one card in their opening hand that's just saying make them have it, if they have that one card, whatever that one card is that's going to hose you, and you lose if they have that one card, A, you're playing a bad deck if it's that loose, if it's loose to one common card in the format, or maybe you need to mulligan to six if it means you're going to have backup or you're going to have a second thread or whatever it is.
I guess, like, a comparable situation is Splinter Twin.
Sure.
Because Splinter Twin is a deck that very much has to have the consideration of make them have it, because But if they don't have it, they win on their upkeep.
Right.
Right.
Where this deck can probably mulligan a little bit harder.
Yeah.
Because it has, now with especially Dig Through Time, but like mm-hmm. normally I would say it wouldn't because, you know, it just needs to have enough dig and to be able to get to lands on time and be able to get really get there because it just needs to draw one part of its combo if it has one piece already. So I kind of want to get around to final thoughts for mulliganing so we can move on. You know, the one rule that I always kind of want to make sure is that you need to look at your hand and say, ask yourself, do you believe that this can win? And then think about all that entails, but if it doesn't, then you should be mulliganing.
Right. And I think that's definitely the basic level one thinking you should have. But if, let's say you're at a big tournament, you've practiced a lot, I'm ready for this, right? My rule of thumb is if I think about mulliganing the hand for a second, I just do it immediately.
Really?
Just snap it off. Yeah. If I think about it for a sec.
So, okay, this is, but so we touched like a little bit further just on the idea of like, if you say to yourself, if they have X card in their hand that is a common card in the format, mm-hmm. and I can't win if they Thoughtseize me or path this creature, do you throw the hand away or not?
But this is...
That question shouldn't be asked if you're playing a deck that's competent and modern, because they're... Like, your deck should be built in a way... If that you ask that question, if that card exists, especially if the card is played a lot...
Yeah.
Like, theoretically, if it's like, oh, this obscure card, they probably don't have... Never mind. But, like, you shouldn't play that deck.
I'm talking more, because, like, if this is... I've practiced probably... If this is, like, I play 200 games of this format.
Right.
500 games of the format.
It's all with this deck. You're ready to
go. All with this deck. All with this limited format. I'm ready to go. Like, you should be processing that... If they have it, do I have it? Kind of like little mini game series. That should be processing very fast, and that should go into your decision. I should mull this, or if I think about mulliganing this, then I should just mull it.
It's actually very interesting. Recently, Cracked.com did a podcast on the fact that your brain does a lot of thinking and processing without you even realizing it's happening.
Right.
And generally, and this is kind of why on SATs or like tests, they also tell you to do this. Whatever your first reaction to something is more often than not going to be the correct one if you know what you're talking about in that situation.
Right.
And if you're proficient with a deck, you've tested it, you played it with against your friends a lot, and you actually get good at it, you should be able to trust your gut in these situations where this hand isn't good. Or like even if you're like, anytime you're like, I don't know if I want to keep it.
Exactly.
The hard, fast rule most pros will tell you, at least at this level, is ship it.
Yeah, definitely.
There is a level where knowing the format and knowing what your deck is doing, but that also comes with that. Like, if I know my deck and I play my deck, knows my deck mulligans well, then I'll lean towards that. If I like my deck doesn't mulligan well, then I will not have that emotional reaction of, this hand isn't good, because it's going to be like, well, my deck doesn't mulligan well, so I should keep most hands.
I just think it's very interesting. I remember watching at least a couple pros. Paul Reitzel comes to mind a couple years ago at Avison Restored, where he goes to 5, I think, in the top 4. And what I wish is that there was sort of 5 minutes after one of these moments where a pro has to go to 5, where they get walked through by the commentator. Hey, can you tell me why you went to 6 and then to 5? You know what I mean?
Yeah. The most recent example that comes to my mind is Pro Tour Gate Crash, where it was Eric Froelich versus Tom Martell, the eventual winner.
Okay.
It's game five, actually. Super tense. This is when the series were 5. But last game, very tense. Froelich snap keeps his 7 on the play, and Martell is like really, really tanking on 6. Then he goes to 5, right?
Right.
And I remember he's playing the Aristocrats, and his hand is like 2 lands, double Boros Reckoner, and then like a blank, right?
Sure.
So, like, this hand is like super, super bad. If he doesn't draw another land, if he draws like another 3-mana spell, there were a lot of tap land. There were some tap lands in that format, and there were both check lands too, which are like the... If they come in, if you don't have a Plains or something.
Oh, the enhanced lands.
Right, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, he tanks for a long time, he keeps it, and then he draws land into Blasphemous Act and just wins. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that's obviously a situation where he was rewarded for just, like, going with it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and that's also, I mean...
What are you going to do, go to 4?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it comes down to, every time you go down a card, you also have to realize that your chances go down if you go down a card. So at 5, my chances plummet going down to 4. My chances aren't great now, but is it better than the plummeted terrible that is at 4 cards? And most likely it was, because he had outs like that. He had the ability to just, like, draw land, win in by turn 4, where... And that's a consideration you have to take into account. Knowing what is possible, what your deck can do. And like, we kind of say this every podcast, But testing is the most important thing that possibly can happen.
It definitely is.
Knowing what your deck can do, knowing what the format is like. And, you know, one of the things we're trying to do this podcast, and the reason we do deck techs every week, is to give a broad understanding of these are the decks you're facing and these are decks you should consider when you're testing.
Yeah, the gauntlet, so to speak.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, listening to this podcast as a series is like it's on super gauntlet of gauntlets on gauntlets on gauntlets.
Except that we just talk about sweet cards also.
Yeah, all the sweet cards. Speaking of deck techs and crucibles of many decks that we have to beat, I want to get in the deck tech today, and that is going to be Scapeshift.
Oh, yeah. That was kind of actually unavailable originally when we first got into Modern with the original ban list.
Mm-hmm. Right. Interesting fact, and one of the reasons we're going to cover it right now, is it actually it was the runner-up in this last weekend's GP Madrid.
Yep.
Why don't you tell us kind of what the cards do in the deck and how the deck works.
All right, so the plan for Scapeshift is to eventually ramp up to 7 lands, and then you resolve Scapeshift, which reads you sacrifice any number of lands, and then put that many lands into play. So what you do is you sack all of your lands, you get 1 Valakut, and 6 mountains, so you can play like Steam Vents or Stomping Ground, because it's usually Rug.
Right.
So you get Valakut and 6 mountains, and then you dome them for 18.
One of the reasons that Scapeshift as a card is unique in its effect is that there have been a lot of search your library for lands, cards printed in history, but there's not a whole lot of them that let you get any land and any number. That's why it's always been historic so powerful. You can get non-basics, you can get basics, you can get...
Yeah, but the deck is usually pretty fast to get to 7 lands because you play Search for Tomorrow and Sakura Tribe Elder, and another reason why going off at 7 is so efficient is because in Modern, a lot of people have Shock Lands, Thoughtseize, Fetch Lands.
Right.
So you can go off essentially a turn earlier on 7 lands rather than waiting for 8 lands,
right.
But you can dome them for 21 after that.
And not to mention you're also playing a lot of lists play Lightning Bolt. You also have Sakura Tribe Elders, and it's not ridiculous to start attacking your opponent for just a little bit of damage. There are many ways the deck can kind of get them to 18. And worst case scenario, if you have 8 land, you can fetch the lands and get 2 Valakuts and 6 lands again and dome them for 36 damage, which also helps against life gain and other problematic situations.
So because this deck is a deck that's going to try to get you on, like, what's the earliest can win? Turn 4?
It can win on turn 5 with counter backup.
So, yeah, that's why this deck, the whole early game, is all going to be filled with just, like, the best blue and green and, well, not green, but basically the blue and red spells that all these things.
Yeah, the best blue and red spells.
Remand and Cryptic Command and Lightning Bolt, just, like, controlled early game, counter, burn, et cetera, et cetera.
It's where Twin is very much a tempo combo deck. This is a control combo deck. It's trying to stop you from what you're doing, survive, and then it'll just insta-win as soon as it's able.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just trying to get that inevitability of, like, it's got really powerful cards in the upper echelon.
Which is one of the major decks that plays actually Cryptic Command, which is, like, we said earlier, there's not a lot of good catch-all answers for counter spells, and this is the one that literally stops everything once you can cast it.
Right.
And is just also, like, does 18 other things that the deck needs to do.
Yeah, it has some really good matchups against Birthing Pod.
Right.
Birthing Pod is one of its best matchups. Game 1, it's pretty much 80-20 in Game 1. It's very hard for Birthing Pod to win because you can remove their Hierarch and then you can tap draw until you draw Scapeshift.
Right.
So
the decks that don't have a way to interact with you on your level and can't race you are your best matchups.
Yeah.
Because if they're not going to kill you before you can combo, then you're fine. And if they can't stop you from comboing itself, then there's no way you can lose.
Yeah.
And Birthing Pod doesn't have a lot of ways to really interact with you on a level that you can't counter-interact and then just win against them.
Right.
For instance, you know, one of the major cards that gets brought in against Scapeshift, Aven Mind Censor, which prevents people, I mean, it's a little, but basically prevents people from searching through their libraries.
Right.
Isn't as much of a problem for the deck because for two reasons. One, worst case scenario, the sacking your lands and searching for more lands is part of the resolution. It's not part of the cost.
Right.
So if they flash it in, you don't have to do it. You lose the value of the card, but you have Snapcaster Mage to buy it back, and you have 3 other ones and many ways to dig for it.
It's not like playing Harrow where you sack 2 lands.
Right.
Or you sack a land.
Digging for other cards.
Possibly Time.
Possibly Time, yeah. With the inception of Dig Through Time in Khans of Tarkir, this deck has really shot up to the upper echelon of
power level.
Yeah, definitely top tier deck. Right when Dig was spoiled, a friend of mine who plays it just jammed three of them in his deck, and it just made the matchup so much more difficult.
Right, for the decks that could even handle on a level, because
right.
if you stop the first one,
right.
it now is a way better way to go find the next ones,
yeah.
and with it, counter magic to protect it.
Right, because after you get in, like, a counter war, you're like, they're like, Scapeshift, you're Mana Leak, then they go Remand of my Scapeshift, and then you're like, Mana Leak again, that just puts so many cards into the graveyard.
Right.
They could just... end of turn dig because they have seven lands.
Well, and this is also, you know, since then, a card that kind of has been under the radar in Modern and just since Cons was printed has shot up in how many decks are playing it is Izzet Charm. And it's great in this situation because, you know, it's replacing some of the looser that are better than what it's doing to dig, but like the looser ways to dig for cards, like mm-hmm. Telling Time, with Dig Through Time. And one of the reasons is, like, you drawing two and discarding two, yes, it's kind of like a mulligan,
yeah.
where you're netting less one card advantage, but you're also filling your graveyard, so it's kind of netting two mana and drawing you two cards, or, like, making your hand
three
two
mana.
Cards better. Yeah,
three
netting
mana.
three mana. And so that makes your dig through time so much stronger. It can dig you to your dig through times.
Yeah.
And not to mention your scape shifts on your other way to make your yeah. combo work. So it's kind of, the deck has become much more efficient and all the cards working together much
yeah.
stronger than they used to be. And on top of that, it was already a very strong deck.
Yeah, so, like, sometimes when you dig, you just, you find another shovel and another card advantage.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty insane.
Yeah, it is interesting that Izzet Charm got so much better with Delve being a powerful effect now. I mean, at Delve, obviously, the original Delve was, like, not super overwhelming. It mm-hmm. had, like, one good card.
Tombstalker.
Yeah, Tombstalker was the best card. I mean, the other two, there were three Delve cards originally. Tombstalker was the one that saw the most play.
Logic Knot
was maybe the second, which is a counter spell.
Yeah.
And then the other one was a removal spell in a format where Goyf was, that couldn't kill green creatures,
yeah,
where
right.
Goyf was the best creature, yeah. so it didn't see any play.
yeah.
Yeah, what did Glenn always say about Dig versus Cruise? He'd take two of his top seven over three for the extra mana.
Oh, yeah. Dig is...
It's like, no question.
This is the kind of the... Like, we've talked a lot about decks where Cruise is very good.
Yeah.
And though it looks like Dig Through Time is just better than Cruise in Modern as well, mm-hmm. but, like, Dig definitively does more powerful things.
Yeah.
In decks like this, where you're looking for specific cards, not necessarily an amalgamation of cards.
Right, yeah.
Which is, you know, we were talking about this earlier, this is a deck that mulligans worse than, say, something like Delver, because Delver, most of the cards in Delver's deck are the same.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
exactly. It's the whole redundancy effect.
Like, right, which is why Treasure Cruise is a good card in that deck. And a good way to, like, we didn't really talk about this earlier, but if your deck has better with Dig Through Time than Cruise, your deck mulligans worse than if you're playing Cruise.
yeah. <definitely. laughs>
It's like a weird loose rule. You, if you're playing Dig Through Time, your deck is looking for specific cards, which means card advantage is king.
Yep.
So we've covered, basically, in that discussion, the fact that that's the cantrips, that's the card draw, that's the early game, the control. Now, aside from Scapeshift, the deck can win in other ways. It does have high-end
yeah.
threats.
Often what it does is, after sideboard, it brings in a few major threats because people will side out all of their creature removal. If you're playing against a white, blue, white, red, generally their game plan is, okay, my Path to Exiles are terrible because they have zero creatures. And the creatures
yeah.
that they do have, they are meant to get them more lands, which Path to Exile does
yeah.
for them. So they take out their best removal spell, and you can put in cards like Inferno Titan. Like, you know, these are cards that are going to have big card advantage, These are cards that are going to come down and be hard to kill, and they don't have the kill spell anymore and going
right.
to end them quickly.
It's always funny when you play against, like, sort of, I mean, this is definitely a combo deck, but, like, combo decks in general, you always worry about, like, at the early game, you're going to counter the spell, disrupt the strategy, stop what they're trying to do, and you forget that if you side out enough cards to do that, and you make your deck
right.
less effective,
mm-hmm.
you're just going to sit there, and they're going to get to six, and they're just going to cast an Inferno Titan, and
yeah.
you're going to be like, oh... I mean, I've
right.
died. I've played decks against Living End where it's like counter, and then they just like
beat down
5-3,
like terrible,
and you're just like
monstrous Karabin.
And you're just like go. You're like I can't beat your 5-3. I don't have anything. I just
yeah.
you're like draw Thoughtseize. You're like, oh, this is so bad.
Yeah, one of Scapeshift's worst matchup is easily Black Green X,
right?
Because they have Liliana, Thoughtseize, Inquisition, which is like.
Just tears apart the hand. Like, as we said earlier,
so bad for you.
Those cards are great against decks that have problems with mulliganing, and
right.
this is a deck that has that. Like, because every card matters, they take out those cards. Though, sideboard, that's what I was going to bring up, Obstinate Baelock, which is one of the
super
big threats that you bring in, because it's great against aggro strategies in general.
Yeah.
But also, like, they play turn three Liliana, and they make you discard, and you get a free Obstinate Baelock.
Yeah, it's so good, because it can't be Abrupt Decayed, and they take out Dismember against you. It's literally unkillable.
Right.
Yeah, it's just awesome.
Yeah, it, and, you know, these are kind of the decks, like, you know, Batterskull is one of the most common threats for Scapeshift to bring out, because it's like a threat that most decks can't handle, that also, you know, helps your bad matchups, which are like, your bad matchups are the decks that kill you quicker.
Right.
And other than Infect, most of those decks are through life total, and so stuff like Batterskull help you in those matchups. Stuff like Obstinate Baloth help you in the matchup. Mm-hmm. Other threats are, you know, Thrun can sometimes come in because he's a very counterspell.
Thrun's,
you know,
very good.
It helps your control matchup. And I think the last one is, you know, recently Kronos, which is the blue-red god.
Kronos is extremely good.
Is very good. It's a threat that no one really has the ability to handle, especially if they take Path out. And you're not turning it on, so Path isn't going to do anything.
Yeah, it's very difficult to remove.
And so it's just like this, like, card advantage engine that also kills them. So, like, there's not a lot that most decks can do against it.
Right.
You get it earlier because you're ramping.
Just to kind of, like, combine our 2 points of this episode, Mulliganing and Scapeshift, just a quick story about a round that I had at a PDQ in the, I think it was like round 6 in the X1 bracket. So we were both doing pretty well that day. And he keeps his 7. And then my 6 is like 5 lands and Mana Leak. Normally I'd keep that hand if there was a Colonnade in it. Mm-hmm. But there was no Colonnade, so I went down to 5. And my 5 was like 2 tapped lands and 2 Snapcaster Mages. And like a Sphinx's Rev. Like really bad, right? But what ended up happening was, I mean, I drew a land, an untapped land. So I just played 2 Snapcaster Mages and killed him with Snapcaster Mages because he took out all of his Lightning Bolts, his Electrolyzes.
Right.
Right. And he tried to go for the kill without having counter backup. And, I mean, I drew a counterspell, and then that was the game. Just he oversideboarded and Snapcasters killed him.
Yeah, that's definitely we didn't cover it. And I don't think we necessarily need to get into it, but just for the record, that is something definitely to pay attention to when you think about mulliganing. Your whole game plan changes significantly in high impact formats like Modern, where the decks are very powerful, and if you might have really specific threats in your sideboard that you need to draw these cards to win.
And like we didn't bring up, but like Legacy, it's classic. Like if you're playing against Dredge and you're playing Leyline of the Void, like, I've just mulliganed until I drew it. I've gone on the 2-card hands and drew it and then beat them because, like, they can't win anymore.
Another one is in RTR Limited, the 39 Swamp Pack Rat.
Right.
Deal.
That's a good
one, too.
Or the even more fringe but horrible Lost in Woods, Lost in the Woods strategy.
That's
one of the classics.
It's like, I can't beat them. My cards are terrible. I'm just going to take out all my cards and play that one card that I'll just win if I draw it.
42 again. Forests and Lost in the Woods.
I never won a game doing that, but I tried it. I tried more than once.
Nice. Good for you, man.
Let's get to the gauntlet. Actually, we covered, you started to talk about Birthing Pod a little bit already and why Birthing Pod is the matchup that it is. So if you want to build on that, finish that statement, just to recap so we can sort of go down the line here.
Against Scapeshift or?
Yeah, against Scapeshift.
So game one, super lopsided for Scapeshift. Game two, they have Sin Collector in Tumor Exarch, very powerful card. And normally most pod decks play like 4 of Thoughtseize in sideboard.
Right.
Because they're just like,
you need,
super bad.
In some decks, in some decks you need to switch. The decks that is worse for you as a pod player are the decks that Thoughtseize is best against.
Like, pod needs Thoughtseize against like Storm, this deck, and its absolute worst matchup, which is Tron. So,
fair. Blue-Red Delver.
I mean, Blue-Red Delver, this deck has some game against because of the fact that it's playing a lot of removal that's good against them, and it plays at instant speed, and that's kind of one of the best ways to beat Delver.
You're not going to take a lot of cards out against Blue-Red Delver because your deck is already pretty good against it. Because you have Lightning Bolt and Electrolyze, which neutralizes 2 of their biggest threats, and you don't care if they cantrip for years.
And also, they might sit there and try to think about what spells am I going to counter, what am I going to save my counter spells
for. You have Counterflux in your sideboard, which is extremely good against them.
Right, and it comes down to you have much better inevitability than they do. If you can stop what they do, like there's an argument made that you have the best inevitability of any deck in the entire format.
Yeah.
The only deck that I think is even comparable is Tron, in the fact that it can eventually just start tutoring up Emrakuls every turn and killing them with them.
Yeah. Because when they're pointing bolts at your face, you're winning the game.
What do you think the difference on the play on the draw versus Blue Red Delver is with this deck?
I think your matchup is worse if they're on the play, but I think everyone's matchup is worse if Delver's on the play
in general.
And that doesn't necessarily mean you're worse than them if they're on the play, but it definitely means that Delver is just a better deck on the play versus the draw. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you have Bolt, it's fine, but like anything else, it's pretty bad.
And something, if you want to look at GP Madrid, like a new card that hadn't been really been seeing play for a while in the main deck is Pyroclasm. You mentioned this in your top 10 red cards.
Yeah.
Is like, this is a huge hedge against Delver decks. It kind of handles their two major threats. Pyroclasm kind of wipes the board with. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons that the Rug Delver deck that won, that beat Scapeshift for the GP win, one is because Tarmogoyf is a deck that is a card that a lot of decks, especially this, looks like it's not being built currently to beat. Mm-hmm. Like, like this deck doesn't have a lot of answers for Tarmogoyf, because Tarmogoyf was supposed to be a dead card.
Right.
Which is what made it a live card. It's weird how life works.
Cyclical nature of it. Okay, so what about Affinity? What do we think about that matchup?
We have Scapeshift has access to red and green, which means it has Ancient Grudge, which is
one of the best cards. So
good against them.
It also, you know, they run stuff like Crozen's Grip and like all these other, like, green is the best artifact removal.
Yeah. Right.
And like the only card that they don't have access to that's like the Stone Cold Nuts against Affinity is Stony Silence.
Right.
But that's the only one.
Yeah.
Everything else is like kind of in its toolbox and is very strong against them, and they play a lot of it. I mean, it's once again, the thing you have to worry about Affinity is it goes back to the racing situation. Mm-hmm. They're one of the decks that are going to try and kill you before you can combo. And they can, because they can kill you on turn four. You have to try and stop them by turn five.
So game one, your Affinity has a really, really good matchup. But game two...
Not necessarily, because you do have Lightning Bolts. You have...
It's pretty 50-50.
Yeah. Okay. You have Visage Charm, you have Electrolyze, you have Snapcaster Mage Lightning Bolt, which is always good against Affinity.
I mean, obviously Affinity can just nut on you, like... And there's nothing you could do to stop it.
It's probably the highest variance game one deck, right?
Yeah, it's very high variance.
Because if you draw the right hand, it's just like Stone Cold Bananas. But if you get disrupted,
You're on the back foot until you win.
Right,
exactly.
But like the thing is that you'll just win the turn you win.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the strengths of Scapeshift.
If you get to four mana against Affinity, you're going to win.
Yeah.
And it should be noted that Vault Scourge plays the same role as Shock Fetch. Them starting at 18. They often will start at 18. So
they go to 19. Though can also do the opposite, where if they strap any equipment to it or give it any type of power boost, it starts getting them life.
This is true.
Which is why Vault Scourge is good. when it comes down to Affinity is that like it really is a race, and you become much more of the control deck.
Yeah.
Splinter Twin.
That's a great matchup for you. Because when you're Scapeshift, your combo piece is Scapeshift. Their combo piece is Splinter Twin plus a creature.
Right.
So it's a lot harder for them to assemble their combo without you disrupting it, because you have removal and counter spells, which is Stone Cold Nuts against
Splinter
Twin. But your removal is only good against Pestermite. Your removal's not good against...
Yeah, but that's... They usually play two Pestermite, four Deceiver Exarch, so that's like a large... Like, you're already cutting... like two of their win conditions.
Well, the other thing you have to look at is, yes, it's only one of their creatures, but what you're saying is they have to draw then a different combination of the right cards, which is hard for them.
Right. Yeah.
You also run out with counterspells. I mean, you're one of the few other decks in the format. There are really three that are heavy counterspell decks, and you have more than them.
Yeah.
You have arguably better ones than Cryptic Command.
Another thing I want to point out in modern counter battles, a little-known trick is remanding your own spells is actually very, very powerful.
Right.
So, like, if there's, like, a mana leak into a Cryptic Command, you can remand your own Cryptic, and they lose their mana leak, you get your Cryptic back, and you draw a card.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. It seems like a great way to get value out of remand.
Yeah, remand, after playing a lot with it, you can definitely figure out some tricks with it, and it can be a really good card.
Splinter Twin Scapeshift to me, because of the turn 3, turn 4 nature of the combos, it definitely seems like a matchup where you are punished if you are not familiar with the way... If you're not familiar with the matchup and you haven't practiced and you don't know, like, I need to sneak this in, I should tap their land so they don't have their counterspell open kind of a thing, I feel like you get punished. If you're a really experienced player, I feel like either side could navigate the win.
Right.
It's probably not going to be on turn four. It's probably going to be a little later than that.
Yeah.
Both of these decks, like, function 80% on the stack. So, understanding how counter magic works, understanding how remands can kind of interact with your spells and their spells, and knowing the best time of, like, really interacting with them. The other thing is that, you know, Scapeshift is one of the few decks that gets in a lot of counter wars because they ramp into the ability to play multiple counter spells a turn. So they'll play a spell, they'll counter it, and then you still have the extra counter to go above them.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, you know, one of the ways they gain an advantage in these situations, among facts of, you know, playing stuff like Counterflux, which lets you just kind of stop what they're doing, which is an uncounter counter spell.
All right, so in conclusion with Scapeshift, one of the pitfalls of actually going off on 7 is if your opponent has a Cryptic Command, you technically lose the game. Because when you bring in all your Valkut and your other mountains, they can, with the Valkut trigger on the stack, they can bounce a mountain, which will fizzle every single trigger.
Right.
Which means you deal no damage to them.
So, to fight against that, the thing you really need to do...
You don't technically lose the game. You're just in really bad shape.
I guess so, yeah.
Well, one of the problems there is something to consider that we also didn't bring up is your deck has a limited amount of mountains.
Right.
And so,
you can only deal so much damage.
Right, you can only deal so much damage. And say that happens, like, it could become very difficult for your second Scapeshift to really get enough mountains into play to really do the damage you need to do.
Something actually pretty funny about the whole Top 8 of Madrid was there was the Soul Sisters deck.
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's the worst matchup for Scapeshift, like, even worse than Black-Green.
Right, because you just gain infinite...
Yeah.
Pseudo-infinite life, and then you can't kill them anymore.
Yeah, the deck literally cannot beat them.
Right.
It's actually very interesting how that worked
out. It makes sense in the format of what it was appearing to be, because Scapeshift was a deck that's up there. You have Delver, which is a deck that also is, like, all about your life total.
Right.
And you have Burn, which is another deck that's, like, life gain just hoses. And so, like, those three decks all being, like, very weak to their life total being too high makes Soul Sisters a great choice for this weekend.
Yeah, that guy really next leveled the entire tournament by playing a bunch of 1-1s.
Right.
Well, it's, like, really funny, too. And I think Soul Sisters illustrates such an interesting point about competitive level Magic, which is that you take an effect like life gain, which, like, good players usually in limited sets, or when they're set reviews, they always just sort of, like, roll their eyes at, like, oh, gain 4 life. Way to go, buddy. But, like, you know, often at those high levels, like, it's just because it's, you know, maligned so much, people don't pay attention to it. You can get way ahead by getting to 35. A lot of decks just won't be able to take you down. Like, they won't be able to catch up, and your silly life gain cards will just win the game.
Well, there's actually kind of a next level to life gain, because, like, the first reaction of most players to learn is that life gain is bad. That is the first lesson you learn. Yeah, but then the next level is like, oh, wait, life gain is good if it's attached to something that makes it good.
Well, yeah, when it's like Siege Rhino and Thragtusk. Or like,
right, like Batterskull.
Lightning Helix.
Baneslayer Angel. Baneslayer. Like, these are all cards that are, like, classic, like, rulers of the formats they exist in, and they're all just, they're good because they gain you life among damaging or sticking around.
If you look at Lightning Helix as, like, one of the early, like, good life gain spells, it's interesting that, like, you can trace all of them to the second half of Magic. That basically the first 10, 12 years, they just didn't understand that they needed to make it more relevant. Otherwise, Healing Solve, we talked about this last week. When Healing Solve is the white lightning bolt, it's, like, so embarrassing.
Before Lightning Helix, like, Vayne was, like, the answer to burn decks. Uh-huh. You brought it in as a sideboard strategy because there were a few decks that just had problems with it.
Right.
Once they realized that, like, well, and before that, like, the Armadillo Cloak was really the first life gain card to, like, show up and be like, oh, wait.
It's really good, yeah.
It's impossible to beat someone that's beating my face with a creature that is also gaining, like, netting them double life disadvantage. Yeah. Gaining double life disadvantage for me.
It is relatively hilarious that Batterskull and Wyrmcoil were printed in the same block. It's, like, really kind of funny that, like, two colorless massive life gain answers exist as part of one standard cycle. Like,
well, I mean, when new people come to the store, I usually tell them, like, life gain's bad, but it's fine if you maintain a tangible advantage. So, again, if the life gain is stapled onto excellent cards, then it's awesome.
Right. And that's something to pay attention to. Almost every card we stayed that's good at life gain, other than some of the Soul Sister cards that just updated a GP, are the second rider to a card that's already good. Not necessarily already good, but it's, like, the second rider that maybe brings it above that power level.
And on top of that,
like Kitchen Finks is better because it life gains.
Right. But it's already good, right?
Right. It's already a 3/2 efficient threat that can't die.
Siege Rhino is a 4/5 trample for 4 that they lose 3 life. So even just if you didn't gain 3, it still would probably be a pretty good card.
It'd be playable. It probably wouldn't be modern playable, but it would still be definitely playable.
It's relevant. Even a 5/3 that comes into play, and then when it dies, you get another creature.
Right. I mean, life gain is important. Like, what the undying version of Kitchen Finks that nets, like, damages them is just not as good as Kitchen Finks, and the life gain is part of that reason. Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's interesting. I think that pretty much wraps us up for the day. I think we probably can kind of get to the shout-outs and the conclusion here. What do you think, Kes?
Right, yeah, definitely. You know, you can always find me at Kes Wiley on Twitter.
You can find me at Ben_Bateman, or as I always say, find me on Instagram. I hate Twitter. Ben Bateman Media, and Andrew is a creature of the night, so he doesn't use social media.
Right, but you can always find Andrew at the Tables of Heidi Ho Gaming in Santa Monica.
Yes, 1431 Lincoln Boulevard. We are a store who's always accepting new players who want to learn, get better, and my whole thing is, if I surround myself with better players or newer players, I'm always going
to
improve.
Right, because either you're learning the pitfalls that you make by teaching someone new how to play better, and you are getting better by playing people that are better than you. So exactly. It's a all ships rise with the sea.
Yeah, Heidi Ho's a pretty great place to play Magic on the West Side, and Andrew pretty much runs the place when it comes to Magic, so definitely stop by and check that out.
And, you know, as always, we want to kind of shout out our sister podcast, The Command Zone. They do a bunch of Commander content, and it's really awesome. They do deck techs and cool stuff like that, and giveaways. Also, you know, the host of that is in VGHS on RocketJump.com. They just released their last episode ever this Monday.
Oh.
So that is one of the best web series out there. You guys should go check it out. It's awesome. It's Harry Potter meets video games. So
video
that's
Game High
cool.
School is what that stands for, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Video Game High School is the name. And also, Jimmy is raising money for his new web series called Band-Aid. It's a musical web series, and you can win a jet ski or a car. You don't even have to pay money. You can just sign up for the winning of the jet ski and the car, and if you really like the project, you can donate money.
And is the jet ski on the car?
You can, if you win both, you can put it on top of the car. It's not that big of a car, but I mean, you can put a jet ski on anything that you want. It just might break the thing you put it on top of.
Jimmy is a tremendously personable guy. He's very clever, very friendly.
He was on, you know, guest of the podcast last week.
We can't wait to have him back to make fun of ours and us make fun of his top 10 cards in any color in Modern.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Like last week. Again, so I suggest you support Jimmy because he's great.
Yep. And that's kind of it. I hope to see you guys next week. And if we don't, because we may not have an episode next week, and we'll figure that out, and I might edit this out, but if we don't, because it's Thanksgiving, have a good Thanksgiving. Eat a lot of turkey and engorge yourself. And then we'll talk about Magic on the next podcast.
Magic.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.